Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and enjoying, and I hope you're enjoying this lovely, lovely Saturday. I am like a little bit sleep deprived, so I'm just going to focus on making words come out of my mouth today. That's my big plan. I had a really early flight back here this morning to spend time with all of you, and I'm glad to be here. We got a big show today. We've got lots to talk about. We're going to be talking about the number of women in CFO positions in Chicago. Turns out there's more than we think, but a lot of them are only in the nonprofit sector. So we're going to be talking about that. And we're also going to be talking about office designs. You know, we think about Googleizing an office, meaning putting a ping pong table in there or something like that. But it seems like there's another step there and more going on. So we're going to be talking about that. But before that, we have our very good friend, Polly Mawson's on the phone. She is a reporter from Bloomberg. And, you know, it is that time of year where a lot of people are going to a lot of weddings, which means a lot of people are going to a lot of bachelor and bachelorette parties. And, you know, it's more to it than just showing up and going to that and maybe picking up a round. It's really become a very big business with big, big price tags attached to it. And so Polly has written about that. Welcome to the show, Polly.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this, because there's two interesting surveys that you wrote about in this piece at Bloomberg, really kind of breaking down exactly what people are spending on bachelor and bachelorette parties. And the first thing we notice is it's not quite the same number. It seems like bachelor parties have a much higher dollar amount than bachelorette parties. But also, it is an unbelievable amount of money if you're talking about, the wedding party, what they're spending.
Absolutely. And I think there's a misconception that brides and the bridesmaids always spend the most. But in this case, the groomsmen are actually the ones spending close to $1,000, whereas the maid of honor will spend closer to $500, $600. Part of the reason that is because of entertainment. Those groomsmen, they want to go out to Vegas. They want to have a very good time. And, you know, all of that entertainment, shall we say, and booze does not come cheap.
Right, right. But even $500 a person is still pretty pricey, you know, especially if, you know, I've seen a lot of people that are in numerous weddings over the summer. And I think everybody has had that in their lives, that one summer where lots of people get married, or you're in several weddings at once or something like that. That makes for pretty pricey summer right there.
Definitely. $500 is a lot of money for a lot of people. And you have to remember that number actually doesn't even factor in what you spend on the wedding itself. That'd be the attire that you wear to the wedding, the gifts that you purchase. So that's $500 just to celebrate the bachelor or bachelorette party. And in addition to that, a lot of people find it really difficult to say no. I actually went back through the surveys, found some of the respondents and spoke to them, and overwhelmingly people said that even if they didn't have the money, they worked really hard to attend because they didn't want to be in that uncomfortable position where they had to say no to one of their friends.
Gosh, I think we're in a cultural moment here where we need to like hit pause and reevaluate what that is. Because really, I mean, the origin of the bachelor and bachelorette party, let's say this cleanly for radio, but essentially you're celebrating your last free night. But you know, some of the like debauchery that is associated with that, right? It maybe makes a little more sense to celebrate something like that a little bit earlier in that relationship, right? As opposed to like right before you get married. But indeed, like as you say, there's the dress, there's the wedding gift, there's probably a shower gift, there's travel, there's time off work if the wedding's out of town. I mean, it's pretty costly to be in someone's wedding now. So it would be interesting to look at data around what it costs just to be a maid of honor or a groomsman these days. But it is interesting because we do think about women spending the most money on weddings and not so much the men. But I suppose as we start thinking about the things that are associated with bachelor and bachelorette parties, that it perhaps might make sense that men might be spending a little bit more. But I don't know. I've seen some bachelorette parties wandering around here in this neighborhood around Tribune Tower, and some of them are kind of rowdy too. And I've seen them, you know, heard them making plans to go to like a Chippendales equivalent kind of thing. So, but nonetheless, it seems like the men are spending almost double what the women are, really.
Yeah, and part of the reason that the price is going up for both men and women than compared to what it was about 5 years ago is because it's no longer one night of debauchery. It's now a weekend. It's 3 days. It's almost always a trip. And part of the reason that it's a trip is because in the past, you really would have it where you lived. And usually where you lived is where all your friends lived and perhaps even where your family lives, where you grew up. Now, millennials are increasingly moving away from home, which means that they are all traveling to get to these places or they're picking destinations. You're not going to go to a destination for 1-2 days. You're going to go for 3 or 4 days. So then you go from having a $200-$300 trip to a $500-$600 trip really quickly. So the whole concept of a bachelor and bachelorette party has changed from being one party one night to really being one weekend, in some cases even a week.
And interestingly too, I'm in the Gen X group myself, and as people in my age group are having either later weddings or second weddings, some of those bachelor and bachelorette parties are a lot more involved. I know someone who took an international trip with friends for her bachelorette party, and it was her second wedding, and that's fine, and she did that, but still, that's, you know, that's a pretty costly endeavor to go overseas and to ask that of your friends. So it's really interesting, but do you see that going down at any point? I mean, here you're writing about people in this story that are in fact making a living being like bachelor and bachelorette party planners. So it seems like this is only going to get worse where it gets better.
I think it's going to get much worse before it gets better, but I do think that people are going to get better at saying no. I think it's going to become more accepted to say no. Right now, you really don't have a lot of people saying no, so then it's uncomfortable when somebody does. So while I think the trend is going to continue, I think just the human behavior is going to change. And maybe you invite 12 people and you accept that only 6 people are actually going to come, because right now you're mad at those other 6 people. You kind of peer pressure everyone into attending. So I think while the big, you know, lavish parties will still continue, not everyone will be forced to come.
Right. And it would be interesting also to kind of take a look at the kind of the final dollar amount, because I know once you factor in attire, I know a tux rental is much less than buying a dress you will only wear once. So that might be interesting to kind of see if it balances out later in the wedding for men and women. And then what about as we look at same sex couples? Are we seeing, I mean, is that, you know, what kind of bachelor, bachelorette or kind of parties, you know, are we seeing there? Is it any different or the numbers still kind of the same?
You know, the numbers are actually still kind of the same. I spoke with Vegas VIP, which is one of the largest planners in Las Vegas, and they do a lot of same-sex events. And they actually have packages that are the exact same cost. It's roughly $300 to $400 for the package, and they do the same thing no matter what. And they said they've certainly had an increase in same-sex couples coming out to do bachelor and bachelorette parties, but they are still spending just about the same amount of money. The groomsmen tend to spend a little bit more. The brides tend to spend a little bit less.
Very, very interesting data. Well, we will keep an eye on Bloomberg.com to go check out this story by Polly Mossens. It's called "It's More Expensive to Throw a Bachelor Party Than a Bachelorette Party." Head over to Bloomberg.com and find it there. And I'll be sure and tweet this link out a little bit later, too. Thanks for joining us on the show today, Polly.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great Saturday. All right, my friends, we are going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about female CFOs right here in Chicago at very, very big companies. But it may not be the companies that you think. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for spending part of your Saturday with us on this, well, I don't know about beautiful Saturday afternoon. It's a little bit cloudy out there, but it's warm enough. I'll take it, right? Well, our February selves will thank us for enjoying this weather. All right, still lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch show. We're going to be talking a little bit later in the show about offices of the future and how to design them now and what we're starting to think about when we think about designing the perfect office. But right now we have Lisa Bertagnoli, who is a reporter for Crain's Chicago, on the phone with us, joining us for the program. And she has written a really, really interesting piece at chicagobusiness.com, and it's taking a look at female CFOs in Chicago. A lot of Chicago businesses have female CFOs. Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Museum of Science and Industry, The Shed, The Lyric Opera, The Joffrey, Chicago History Museum. What do they have in common? They're all nonprofits. So while we're seeing a lot of female CFOs in the nonprofit sector, we're not seeing that translate necessarily to the for-profit sector. So break all this down for us, Lisa, because it seems like if we're getting, you know, more female leadership, it would just work across the board. Why is it so much kind of corralled over into the nonprofit sector?
That's a good question. I think for the women I talk to, nonprofits are a way to cap off your career. You've made your bones in the for-profit sector, you've made your money, and then maybe stayed home with the kids a few years, and you have a chance to do something you really want to do. And so nonprofits are very attractive to them. All the women I talked to said they loved their job. The work was interesting and challenging. They loved their careers. They loved the idea of giving back, of having meaning to their work. And so that's why I think the nonprofits attract so many women.
Well, fair enough. But how can we use whatever it is we use to get women, to get so many women initially involved in the nonprofit sector, whatever thing that has inspired women to go there at whatever point in their career, how do you think we can use that to kind of increase it across the board just to see more women in leadership?
Meaning? I'm not sure I understand the question.
That's okay.
Sorry.
Well, that's all right. Well, you know, I think there's been a lot of dialogue in the last handful of years about getting women in leadership across the board, that we still have a great gender disparity there between male leadership and female leadership. And so if we have all these women in the nonprofit sector, are there things that the for-profit sector can look at that has made it so, so workable and so attractive to so many female leaders to try to increase that gender balance across the board in all kinds of industries?
Curiously enough, I think the opposite is true. Nonprofits, the name is a misnomer. Nonprofits are businesses. They have to make money. They have to take very good care of the money that they make because their scrutinizers aren't the public markets, but their donors. And if they take good care of their money, they're more likely to get donors to keep on going. But they've only recently begun to think of themselves as businesses and do the kind of things that for-profits have done for a long time, and that's take good care of your workers, make sure they're happy, make sure there's tracks for people to hop on and off of as their family lives progress, et cetera. So I think nonprofits are trailing in that respect a little bit, and they're trying to catch up. I did a little research before this call, and I looked at that GuideStar report that is mentioned in my story. GuideStar is a very good source of all sorts of information about nonprofits, and in the report that I cite, which is where I got the statistics about female CFOs and the money they make, it's the same kind of dynamic. The bigger the organization, the fewer women there are. At the top level of nonprofits, which are budgets of $50 million a year or more, only 18% of the CEOs are women, whereas for budgets of $250,000 or less, which is a tiny, tiny organization, it's 55%. So there you see the same kind of numbers that you see in the for-profit world. The really, really big nonprofit organizations still have a lot of men in leadership positions.
Certainly. And as you note in your story, there seems to be less of an issue getting women into certain leadership roles, this being one of them. Other ones being where we see a lot of women in leadership are around HR, around marketing, things like that. So are there any other spots where you see kind of an influx of female leadership?
In nonprofits?
Kind of across the board, really.
Certainly HR, marketing, media relations, communications, the misnamed softer side of business. It's not soft at all to handle human resources for a very large company, be it nonprofit or for-profit. But that seems to be where the women are and the women go.
And so do you think there's anything that you learned from working on this story it seems like an obvious thing that other leadership roles could do to try to attract more women to them?
Well, the women I talked to, overall, they were very happy with their jobs. They loved the people. They loved the work. The work was interesting. It was diverse. The work was diverse. They weren't looking at the same things to do every day. And I think there's a lesson right there. If people, women, men, if they like their jobs, they like coming to work every day, they'll stay and they'll make a company a better place to work. I mean, there's nothing worse than going into an office where everybody hates their job. There's nothing better than going to work every day where people are happy to do their job, they're doing it well, they have smiles on their faces, they laugh and joke with each other. You know, your work life is your home away from home. And I think a happy home life at work is as important as a happy home life at home, if that makes sense.
Certainly. And are you seeing similar trends with younger workers who are entering the workforce? That's the same kind of division there of more women going into marketing or HR, nonprofit, and more men going into, you know, other sorts of roles. Does that split happen there, or does it happen later in the career?
I see a huge trend, especially in Chicago, of younger people, men and women, starting socially responsible businesses, whether they're for-profit businesses that give back to charities, whether it's a straight up and up nonprofit. I see more and more little nonprofits started by people in their 20s. So I think a certain group of people in their 20s, they're saying, forget this for-profit stuff. This is what I want to do with my life. I want to make a difference, so I'm going to start my own nonprofit and run it my own way. So we'll see when those nonprofits grow up to be $50 million companies. I think that they will have an entirely different way of managing themselves than companies today, because they are being started by these millennials who have, you know, maybe it's a stereotype, but they do, at least the ones I've encountered, have a certain way of looking at life and work.
Certainly. Yeah, I think that we've talked about that very trend here in this program before, this idea that a lot of younger workers or any way to engage them, to keep them engaged, there has to be a very deep sense of purpose connected to their work, which I agree. I think that will be really interesting to see what happens when the millennial workforce is nearing retirement age within, you know, 10 or 15 years of that. It'll be interesting to see what the workforce even looks like then. It'll be very, very interesting. Well, everybody head to chicagobusiness.com and check out the story. It's called Women's Work, Nonprofit CFO. And thank you very much for joining us today on the program. Lisa Bertagnoli, she's a reporter there. We will follow you for this and other wonderful stories.
Please do. Thank you so much.
Certainly. Have a great Saturday.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, my friends, still lots to talk about here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to be talking about the future of offices. What does that mean, not just for ergonomics, but for design and how we work and how we do our work and how we report the work we're doing, all of those things, and how technology factors in. We're going to be taking a look at that here in just a little bit here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hope you got an umbrella with you. It's looking a little bit soggy out there. We will keep you plugged in with weather here in just a bit with our good friend Bob Kessler. We have still plenty to talk about on the show today, including we're stepping into vacation time. So we're going to be talking a little bit about road trips here in just a little bit. But right now we're joined by our good friend Megan Graham, who is a reporter for Blue Sky Innovation upstairs at the Tribune. Hi, Megan. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So you had a very, very interesting piece at ChicagoTribune.com lately that really caught my eye. And it's all about designers predicting the future of office spaces, which I think is really interesting, because personally, I rolled my eyes a little bit at the trend at the trend to kind of Googleize your workplace and put in like an arcade or a ping pong table or something. While that's cool, it's kind of sometimes annoying to other coworkers when people are just kind of slacking off. But in your story, it looks like there's going to be a lot done with data and a lot more thoughtful approach to designing the workplace instead of just forcing fun, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So talk to us about that a bit.
Sure. So, you know, something that's really fun about my job is I get to do a sort of office design feature. So every week we feature a different office. I get to go around, walk around, talk to the CEO or whoever kind of helped design the space, and then walk people through that and say, you know, why did this company want their space to look a certain way? So I talked to these five different design firms about, you know, what are some of the trends that whether it's tech offices or other companies are kind of looking at in terms of making their employees happier, right? Because like you said, it's not just about ping pong tables or arcades. It's really about giving people a place where they can do their job well and, you know, incorporate those elements of fun and privacy and just making sure all those different elements are there in the space.
Well, I love that because, you know, I think everybody has a different definition of what it takes for them to unwind, what is fun to them, what is feels balancing to them. And so I love the idea of a little bit more thoughtful approach to this. And so one of the points you mentioned is about a very impressive communal space. Talk to us mm-hmm. about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, there's a couple big buildings here in Chicago. There's, you know, 111 North Canal. That's where Twitter and Uber have their spaces. And they have this unbelievable, you know, rooftop space and communal game rooms. And sort of the point of that is that these companies really not only want their employees to be sort of collaborating between disciplines, but also they want their employees to be talking to other people from other companies and just kind of having that, they called it cross-pollination. It's kind of you're sharing ideas between companies, and that's kind of next level to just having your employees collaborate among each other. So that's something that a lot more companies are getting interested in when they're looking at buildings. It's not just about, oh, we have this really great amenity floor. It's about having a space where they're able to collaborate, talk to other people from other companies.
Where then it really does impact the bottom line, more or less, as your, you know, ideas are colliding. There's a really interesting YouTube video. It is by Steven Johnson. It's kind of a whiteboard animation. It's about the origin of ideas. That's really, really good. And there's a big theme in there about where the best ideas have been the result of two ideas colliding. And I think that's really kind of what they're getting at, is this idea of letting accidental discoveries sort of happen by putting people with people they don't normally work with.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So there's another point that you make in this piece, and that is all about focusing on health in the workplace, which I think is interesting because, you know, in some, I think a thing I feel like I hear a lot of people say is they have like a love-hate thing with their workplace gym, because on one hand, it's nice to go and work out in the middle of a workday or at the end or the beginning of it, but sometimes it's a little bit awkward to be in a locker room with your coworkers that you're going to be in a meeting with later. But this seems like it's taking it to a very different level with a lot of different options besides just a gym. Talk to us about that part.
Yeah, so something that some of the firms are seeing is actually putting primary care centers in the office or, you know, on the corporate campus. And that's, I mean, basically what they're saying is if their employees and their families are healthy, then they're, you know, more productive, they're more invested in their work. And obviously there's a huge loyalty thing there too, right? I mean, if you can have all that taken care of by your employer and it's easy for you, it's something, you know, it's going to keep people at that company a lot longer than if they're having to worry about dealing with that on their own time.
Certainly. Now, someone might say, though, to be a little bit of a contrarian, someone might say that's a bit of, you know, those are golden handcuffs, and that if you have to go to work to go to the doctor, that might be a bit of a problem.
Yeah, I think that they have to make it optional for people, right? I think it's something that if they want to use it, they can have it and it's easy for them. And obviously give people, don't pressure them into having to use it. People should always have choice because people have different comfort levels, absolutely, with that kind of thing.
Because how else are you going to play hooky if you can't fake exactly. fake a sick day, for crying out loud, if the doctor's right there to rat you out? You know, another thing that I thought was really interesting, it seems like there was a big shift a few years ago away from offices and moving people into a more like a living room kind of space and really embracing the opportunity for collaboration and accidental discovery to happen. But it seems like there might be a shift back to some offices, but in a very different way, too.
Yeah, so exactly. I think it's been in the last 5 years that so many companies have said, all right, we're done with offices, no walls here, nothing but glass, everyone's out in the open, whether you're the CEO or the intern. And a lot of companies, that works really well. But it just doesn't work as well for all companies, right? Some of these traditional, you know, types of companies like financial firms, it doesn't really work if you need to have private conversations with your clients or you need to call your doctor or you need to fire someone. You don't want to do that in the middle of an open floor. It just doesn't work. So what some of these people were saying was that we're probably going to see for some job functions like HR or accounting, see some of these offices come back because just there aren't, some of these jobs are not conducive to having no privacy, no, you know, barrier between you and everybody else. So I do think we're going to start to see a little bit of a more fine-tuned approach to the open office, because I think a lot of people say it's a great concept and it brings a lot of good results, but it just isn't perfect for everyone.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And then it seems like all this is also very much backed up by this very data-driven design, as opposed to just kind of hunches, but really confirming those hunches with real data. But even taking that a step further to allow employees to kind of report and give feedback in real time about the activities they're doing during their workday.
Yeah, so I talked to Perkins & Will, which is a firm. They just moved into the Wrigley Building across from Trip Tower. So when they were thinking about how they were laying out their space, they built this app called Current, and it you know, will send you a notification maybe 5 or 6 times a day and say, what are you doing? What kind of meeting space are you in? How many people are you meeting with? Does the room have a door? All these things that, you know, really help designers figure out what people are doing and using at different points during the day. And then they used that data and they said, okay, our employees love having small meetings. So they built all these small meeting spaces into their new space. So it's really interesting. And like you said, it's kind of backing up that designer intuition, because, you know, you might be able to say, nobody uses this nap couch that we have, so we don't need a nap couch. But maybe that nap couch is right outside the CEO's door. Of course no one's going to use this nap right. couch. You have to move it to a different part of the office. So exactly, it's kind of having that intuition, having those things that they know to be true, backing it up with actual data from employees.
It is really interesting. I mean, it's kind of the idea of like a Fitbit for your workday, really.
Exactly. And so sensors are another thing that designers are starting to use, and just saying how many people are at this place and how many people use these areas, and just kind of, are people at their desks? Are they using their phones? And so all of that can kind of be incorporated to figure out how design should be in the future, and also to help them figure out temperature and lighting and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Is there any sense of backlash against any of that kind of tracking? Are people saying it's cumbersome to have to track, or they don't want to be tracked, or they don't want sensors around them, or are people pretty much embracing it?
Yeah, I think that they're doing it to a level that it's very anonymized. It's not meant to track you and say, are you working? It's kind of more they're using it. They don't know who you are. They mm-hmm. just know, you know, what space is being used, and they can't say like, oh, that's Meg. She's never at her desk because she's always in the game room. It's more, this person's using the game room. This person prefers to spend more time at their desk. And so yeah, I don't know if there's been much of a backlash, but it could be interesting to see as more companies are starting to do that.
Certainly. Well, it is really interesting. And I think anytime we can incorporate technology into our lives to make them better, I'm all for it. So thank you for bringing this story to our attention. And we will continue to turn to you at ChicagoTribune.com's Blue Sky for this and other wonderful stories. Thank you so much, Megan Graham, for joining
Thanks,
us
Amy.
Today. Have a great day.
Bye.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we are talking about road trips, because it is that time of year where people are starting to look at the road trip and the vacation and all that good stuff. So we'll talk about that here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. In a little bit, we're going to be turning you over to King John. I'm sure he's got lots of great stuff lined up for you. We'll be talking to him in just a little bit. You know, a very interesting thing has occurred with travel. So the 2008 financial crisis hit, and of course, not many folks had much extra, you know, had a lot of extra money sitting around with which to travel. But right now, as the economy is coming back and starting to revive, and gasoline has been less expensive than it has been in about 11 years, according to the AAA Motor Club, a lot of people are embracing the great American road trip again, which I, for one, think is super fantastic. But another piece of this is it seems like during the financial crisis, this shift came about that was really this sense of, you know what, you can take away my job and my house and you can put me in debt, whatever. But you know what? Memories matter, and the experiential matters a great deal. And I think we're even seeing that trend in advertising over the last couple of years, shifting to a more experiential thing rather than just here's your ad, buy it or don't. And so it's very interesting to see this this taking hold in the vacation area too. And you know, right now you can go to on WGNradio.com. There's a really cool road trip series. WGN's own Dave Schwann went to six parks around the Midwest that are just so beautiful. He's celebrating the 100th year of the national parks. And he joined me on the Saturday night program last week. We had a great time. I mean, he's so wonderful and he has such great information, but he was talking all about these wonderful parks that he visited all within a few hours of Chicago. And he did this trip with his dad and that was really special and great. But we started talking about how road trips have changed so much, mostly because so many families just haven't gone on them. They've gone on a lot, we're a global economy and people go on longer trips in different places. And I mean, it used to be that you would put off a big once in a lifetime trip till after retirement. But now, the millennial travel demographic is huge. And so many people are taking really ambitious trips really early in their lives. So that's a shift. But Dave Schwann and I, nonetheless, were talking about how when we were kids, how different road trips were. And it wasn't like, now you hand a kid an iPad and then a few hours later they look up and you're there and that's it. So I don't know. Did you road trip a lot as a kid, Griffin?
A couple times, yeah. I remember a Graceland trip.
Oh,
pretty,
nice.
Pretty well.
We were the road tripping family. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah, I don't think it was our identity, but we did a couple. Where'd you go?
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
The road tripping. But we're a road tripping family that is a product of road tripping families because both of my parents came from road tripping families that, but then that's just how you did it. When my parents were growing up, that was the family vacation. There was no like flying somewhere. It was all about the road trip.
And they were probably very good with directions and finding their way then.
You know what? My mom is amazing with an actual paper map. Mm-hmm. I don't have that skill.
That's a lost skill.
I know.
It's dying off. Yeah.
She gives me so much grief about that because I always need the GPS. And she'll just like get the map and she'll come up with some information that I have no idea how she got that. Like, well, no, that exit's closed. How do you know that? From the map that was printed 5 years ago. I don't know how she does that, but it's a skill I really admire. And I'm sure there's lots of people that just heard me say that and are like rolling their eyes right there.
I know. You're like, where does it say on that map from 10 years ago what the traffic is like right now?
See? Because
how did they know? How did they know?
It's a blend. There's a blend. Like technology can help you troubleshoot things on the fly. But yeah, I think it's important to be able to like read the maps and all that.
Well, that's kind of part of the whole experience of a road trip, I assume, was
getting lost
and then finding your way again, which, yeah, maybe the road trip is back, but it's kind of in a different form, maybe. I mean, anybody can find a way to get lost no matter what you're looking at. But
I wonder if now that we have such access to GPS devices, if there is less of a willingness to go and get lost on a road trip. I wonder if that's a more uncomfortable space for people to be in.
I find it very stressful, yeah.
I find it delightful. I love to do that. I mean, I've explored a lot of cities by just getting lost because it's not like I wouldn't do that, say, in a very remote area of wilderness, but like in a city, I would, okay, I'll just, that looks interesting. I'll drive that way. And I've explored and found cool neighborhoods that way and things like that because I know eventually I'll figure out how to get back to my hotel or the highway or wherever I'm going or something like that. So I think it's kind of cool and sometimes serendipitous to be able to just kind of get lost.
Well, Bob's a musician. You've been on the road, right, Bob? Or have
I've
you?
Done some road work. Yeah, I've road tripped several times in Nashville.
Are you a road trip fan?
I love road trips. I think my favorite one was, this was right before everyone had GPS. So this was like 2004. I got in my car and I drove north till I ended up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and camped. And then I just kind of, where now? I ended up circling Lake Huron and went to Manitoulin Island,
nice.
The largest island in the world, inland island, if that makes sense,
sure.
Freshwater island. Huge island.
Who knew?
Beautiful. It's on Lake Huron. I took a 3-hour ferry trip with my car. It drives right into the boat to get back to the Bryce Peninsula in Ontario.
Pretty.
It was awesome.
Nice.
I didn't. I sort of knew I was doing that, but I sort of didn't. So that was cool. And I think I brought a map. I did not have a cell phone that did any mapping stuff. This was 10 years ago.
That's great. I think that's really. When in 2006, when my book came out, I drove a lot of my book tour because I wanted to, and I had some great adventures. Just kind of going like, yeah, okay, I'll be in Atlanta eventually. And so I would just kind of like take my time getting to the next city. And that was a lovely way to explore. It was also like in the fall. So it was very, very pretty. And I think that's but you know what? I mean, I think there's a lot to be said and for the idea of making memories with road trips. Because it is, if you travel to a trip, you're on a plane, you're going to block all that stuff out. Because plane travel is never the joy that a
Seldom
road trip is.
Seldom is it.
Right. I know because today I, yeah.
You got some stories?
Well, you know, actually, it was my way on my way to my destination a couple of days ago. I almost crash landed in Detroit, about as like the home plate sliding into home plate equivalent. So like air travel is never a joy in the way a road trip is. And I fondly remember when I was a kid, we drove to the Grand Canyon and back, and it was so beautiful. And you know, for a minute, like my brother and I were kind of fighting in the car, but then we just kind of chilled out and realized there's beautiful stuff around us and kind of took all that in. And we always played the license plate game where you, you know, see how many states you can find on the highway. You know, and I mentioned that to a friend of mine who's about to go on a road trip with her kids, the license plate game. And the kids were like, that sounds so boring. I would never do that.
No way that's as interesting as my iPad.
Well, you
no
know what?
Way.
One of the kids
they
was like,
they might be onto something.
Well, he goes, is that an app? Like, do you get points for it, or what do you do? How do you level up? And I was like, no, you just. Okay.
Is there a way I can find to spend money on it? I really want to spend money.
Where's
on this.
Where's the in-app purchase? It was so funny how he was just kind of like, why would I do that? What does that get me? this poor kid had no concept of, but yeah, he's got a point.
So like, some of the art of it might have been lost, but yeah, reading from the New York Times, whatever their motivation, Americans last year drove a record 3.15 trillion miles. According to the Department of Transportation, beating the previous mark set in 2007.
I think that's excellent. I think it's character building to be driving around.
Yes. And it was a big deal when we got a cassette player in the car. And we could listen to comedy things like, you wouldn't do it now, but Bill Cosby. We would listen to Bill Cosby.
Sure.
Before we knew what we knew. But
well, I'm the champion of the road trip karaoke, personally. You know, I give some epic concerts to Steering Wheels. Just saying. On that fine note, we're going to take a little break and turn you over to King John here in just a little bit on 720 WGN.